What, 50? 60? I thought there were 500 second sons. 513 at present, Inkpot said. When you sign our book, we will be 514. So only 1 in 10 receives a note. That hardly seems fair. I thought you were all share and share alike in the free companies. He signed another sheet. Brown Ben chuckled.
Oh, share, but not alike. The second sons are not unlike a family.
And every family has its drooling cousins. Tyrion signed another note. The parchment crinkled crisply as he slid it toward the paymaster. There are cells down in the bowels of Casterly Rock, where my lord father kept the worst of ours. He dipped his quill in the inkpot. Tyrion of House Lannister, he stretched out, promising to pay the bearer of the note 100 golden dragons. Every stroke of the quill leaves me a little poorer, or would, if I were not a beggar to begin with. One day he might rue these signatures. But not this day. He blew on the wet ink, slid the parchment to the paymaster, and signed the one beneath. And again, and again, and again. This wounds me deeply, I will have you know, he told them between signatures. In Westeros, the word of a Lannister is considered good as gold. Inkpot shrugged. This is not Westeros. On this side of the narrow sea, we put our promises on paper. As each sheet was passed to him, he scattered fine sand across the signature to drink up excess ink, shook it off, and set the note aside. Debts written on the wind tend to be forgotten, shall we say. Not by us. Tyrion signed another sheet, and another. He had found a rhythm now. A Lannister always pays his debts. Plum chuckled.
Aye, but a sellsword's word is worthless.
Well, yours is, thought Tyrion, and thank the gods for that. True, but I will not be a sellsword until I've signed your book.
Soon enough, said Brown Ben. After the notes.
I'm dancing as fast as I can. He wanted to laugh, but that would have ruined the game. Plum was enjoying this, and Tyrion had no intention of spoiling his fun. Let him go on thinking that he's bent me over and fucked me up the ass, and I'll go on buying steel swords with parchment dragons. If Every went back to Westeros to claim his birthright, he would have all the gold of Casterly Rock to make good on his promises. If not, well, he'd be dead, and his new brothers could wipe their asses with these parchments. Perhaps some might turn up in King's Landing, with their scraps in hand, hoping to convince his sweet sister to make good on them. And would that I could be a roach in the rushes to witness that. The writing on the parchments changed about halfway down the pile. The 100 dragon notes were all for sergeants. Below them, the amount suddenly grew larger. Now Tyrion was promising to pay the bearer 1,000 golden dragons. He shook his head, laughed, signed, and again, and again. So, he said as he was scrolling, what will be my duties with the company?
You are too ugly to be Bococo's butt boy, said Casporio, but you might do as Arrow father.
Better than you know, said Tyrion, refusing to rise to the bait. A small man with a big shield will drive the archers mad. A wiser man than you once told me that.
You will work with Inkpots, said Brown Ben Plum.
You will work for Inkpots, said Inkpots. Keeping books, counting coin, writing contracts and letters.
Gladly, said Tyrion.
I love books.
What else would you do? Sneered Casporio. Look at you. You are not fit to fight.
I once had charge of all the drains in Casterly Rock, Tyrion said mildly. Some of them had been stopped up for years, but I soon had them draining merrily away. He dipped the quill in the ink again. Another dozen notes, and he would be done. Perhaps I could supervise your camp followers. We can't have the men stopped up, now can we?
That jape did not please Brown Ben.
Stay away from the whores, he warned. Most of them are poxy, and they talk. You're not the first escaped slave to join the company, but that don't mean we need to shout your presence. I won't have you parading about where you might be seen. Stay inside as much as you can and shit into your bucket. Too many eyes at the latrines, and never go beyond our camp without my leave. We can dress you up in squire steel, pretend you're Jarrah's butt boy, but there's some will see right through that. Once Meereen is taken and we're away to Westeros, you can prance about all you like in gold and crimson. Till then, though,
I shall live beneath a rock and never make a sound. You have my word on that.
Tyrion of House Lannister, he signed once more with a flourish. That was the last parchment. Three notes remained, different from the rest. Two were written on fine vellum and made out by name. For Casporio the Cunning, 10,000 dragons. The same for Inkpots, whose true name appeared to be Tybaro Esterion.
Tybaro? Said Tyrion. That sounds almost Lannister. Are you some long-lost cousin?
Perhaps. I always pay my debts as well. It is expected of a paymaster. Sign.
He signed. Brown Ben's note was the last. That one had been inscribed upon a sheepskin scroll.
100,000 golden dragons, 50 hides of fertile land, a castle and a lordship. Well and well. This plum does not come cheaply.
Tyrion plucked at his scar, and wondered if he ought to make a show of indignation. When you bugger a man, you expect a squeal or two. He could curse and swear, and rant of robbery, refuse to sign for a time, then give in reluctantly, protesting all the while. But he was sick of mummery, so instead he grimaced, signed, and handed the scroll back to Brown Ben.
"Your cock is as big as in the stories," he said. "Consider me well and truly fucked, Lord Plum."
Brown Ben blew on his signature.
"My pleasure, imp. And now we make you one of us. Inkpots, fetch the book."
The book was leather-bound with iron hinges and large enough to eat your supper off. Inside its heavy wooden boards were names and dates going back more than a century.
"The second sons are amongst the oldest of the free companies," Inkpot said, as he was turning pages. "This is the fourth book. The names of every man to serve with us are written here. When they joined, where they fought, how long they served, the manner of their death, all in the book. You will find famous names in here, some from your seven kingdoms. Aegor Rivers served a year with us before he left to found the Golden Company. Bit of steel, you call him. The Bright Prince, Aerion Targaryen, he was a second son. And Roderick Stark, the Wandering Wolf, him as well. No, not that ink. Here, use this."
He unstoppered a new pot and set it down. Tyrion cocked his head.
"Red ink?" "A tradition of the company," Inkpots explained. "There was a time when each new man wrote his name in his own blood. But as it happens, blood makes piss-poor ink. Lannisters love tradition. Lend me your knife."
Inkpots raised an eyebrow, shrugged, slipped his dagger from its sheath, and handed it across, hilt first.
"It still hurts, half-maester. Thank you very much," thought Tyrion, as he pricked the ball of his thumb.
He squeezed a fat drop of blood into the inkpot, traded the dagger for a fresh quill, and scrawled, "Tyrion of House Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock," in a big, bold hand, just below Jorah Mormont's far more modest signature.
"And it's done."
The dwarf rocked back on the camp stool.
"Is that all that you require of me? Don't I need to swear an oath, kill a baby, suck the captain's cock?"
"Suck whatever you like." Inkpots turned the book around and dusted the page with a bit of fine sand.
"For most of us,
The signature suffices. But I would hate to disappoint a new brother-in-arms. Welcome to the second sons, Lord Tyrion.
Lord Tyrion. The dwarf liked the sound of that. The second sons might not enjoy the shining reputation of the Golden Company, but they had won some famous victories over the centuries. Have other lords serve with the company?
Landless lords, said Brown Ben. Like you, imp.
Tyrion hopped down from the stool.
My previous brother was entirely unsatisfactory. I hope for more from my new ones. Now how do I go about securing arms and armor?
We want a pig to ride as well,
asked Casporio.
Why, I did not know your wife was in the company, said Tyrion. That's kind of you to offer her, but I would prefer a horse.
The bravo reddened, but Inkpots laughed aloud, and Brown Ben went so far as to chuckle.
Inkpot, show him to the wagons. He can have his pick from the company's teal. The girl, too. Put an elm on her, a bit of mail. Might be. Some will take her for a boy.
Lord Tyrion, with me.
Inkpots held the tent flap to let him waddle through.
I will have Snatch take you to the wagons. Get your woman and meet him by the cook tent.
She is not my woman. Perhaps you should get her. All she does of late is sleep and glare at me.
You need to beat her harder and fuck her more often, the paymaster offered helpfully. Bring her, leave her, do what you will. Snatch will not care. Come find me when you have your armor, and I will start you on the ledges.
As you wish. Tyrion found Penny asleep in a corner of their tent, curled up on a thin straw pallet beneath a heap of soiled bedclothes. When he touched her with the toe of his boot, she rolled over, blinked at him, and yawned.
Hugo, what is it?
Talking again, are we? It was better than her usual sullen silence. All over an abandoned dog and pig.
I saved the two of us from slavery. You would think some gratitude might be in order.
If you sleep any longer, you'll like to miss the war.
I'm sad, she yawned again, and tired. So tired.
Tired or sick? Tyrion knelt beside her pallet. You look pale. He felt her brow. Is it hot in here, or does she have a touch of fever? He dared not ask that question aloud. Even hard men like the second sons were terrified of mounting the pale mare. If they thought Penny was sick, they would drive her off without a moment's hesitation.
They might even return us to Yesen's heirs, notes or no notes.
I have signed their book, the old way, in blood. I am now a second son. Penny sat up, rubbing the sleep from her eyes.
What about me? Can I sign too?
I think not. Some free companies have been known to take women, but, well, they are not second daughters after all.
We, she said, if you're one of them, you should say we, not they. Has anyone seen Pretty Pig? Inkpot said he'd ask after her. Or Crunch. Has there been word of Crunch?
Only if you trust Casporio. Plum's not-so-cunning second-in-command claimed that three yonkish slave-catchers were prowling through the camps, asking after a pair of escaped dwarfs. One of them was carrying a tall spear with a dog's head impaled upon its point, the way that Caspo told it. Such tidings were not like to get Penny out of bed, however.
No word as yet, he lied. Come, we need to find some armor for you.
She gave him a wary look.
Armor? Why?
Something my old master-at-arms told me. Never go to battle naked, lad, he said.
I take him at his word. Besides, now that I am a sellsword, I really ought to have a sword to sell.
She still showed no signs of moving.
Tyrion seized her by the wrist, pulled her to her feet, and threw a fistful of clothing into her face.
Dress, wear the cloak with a hood, and keep your head down. We're supposed to be a pair of likely lads, just in case the slave catchers are watching.
Snatch was waiting by the cook tent, chewing sour leaf, when the two dwarfs turned up, cloaked and hooded.
"I hear the two of you are going to fight for us," the sergeant said. "That should have them pissing in Meereen. Either of you ever killed a man?"
"I have," said Tyrion. "I swat them down like flies."
"What with?"
"An axe, a dagger, a choice remark. Though I'm deadliest with my crossbow." Snatch scratched at his stubble with the point of his hook.
"Nasty thing, a crossbow. How many men you kill with that?"
"9. His father accounted for at least that many, surely. Lord of Castle Rock, Warden of the West, Shield of Lannisport, Hand of the King, Husband, Brother, Father, Father, Father."
"9,
Snatch snorted, and spat out a mouthful of red slime, aiming for Tyrion's feet, perhaps, but it landed on his knee. Plainly, that was what he thought of 9. The sergeant's fingers were stained a mottled red from the juice of the sour leaf he chewed. He put 2 of them into his mouth and whistled.
"Kem, get over here, you fucking pisspot."
Kem came running.
"Take Lord and Lady Imp to the wagons. Have Hammer fix them up with some company steel." "Hammer might be passed out, drunk," Kem cautioned. "Piss in his face, that'll wake him up."
Snatch turned back to Tyrion and Penny. "We never had no bloody dwarfs before, but boys we never lacked for. Sons of this whore or that one. Little fools run off from home to have adventures. But boys, squires and the like. Some of their shit might be small enough to fit imps. It's the shit they were wearing when they died, like as not. But I know that won't bother fuckers fierce as you two. 9, was it?"
He shook his head and walked away.
The second sons kept their company armour in 6 big wains drawn up near the centre of their camp. Kem led the way, swinging his spear as if it were a staff. "How does a King's Landing lad end up with a free company?" Tyrion asked him. The lad gave him a wary squint.
"Who told you I was from King's Landing?"
"No one. Every word out of your mouth reeks of flea bottom.
Your wits gave you away.
There's no one clever as a Kingslander, they say." That seemed to startle him.
"Who says that?"
"Everyone."
"Me?"
"Since when?"
"Since I just made it up." "For ages," he lied. "My father was wont to say it. Did you know Lord Tywin, Kem?"
"The end. Once I saw him riding up the hill. His men had red cloaks and little lions on their helms. I like those helms." His mouth tightened. "I never liked the hand, though. He sacked the city, and then he smashed us on the Blackwater."
"You were there?"
"With Stannis. Lord Tywin come up with Renly's ghost and took us in the flank. I dropped my spear and ran, but at the ships this bloody knight said, 'Where's your spear, boy? We got no room for cravens.' And they buggered off and left me, and thousands more besides. Later I heard how your father was sending them as fought with Stannis to the wall. So I made my way across the narrow sea and joined up with the second sons."
"Do you miss King's Landing?"
"Some. I miss this boy. He was a friend of mine, and my brother Kennet, but he died on the Bridge of Ships."
"Too many good men died that day."
Tyrion's scar was itching fiercely. He picked at it with a fingernail.
"I miss the food, too," Kim said wistfully.
"Your mother's cooking?"
"Rats wouldn't eat my mother's cooking. There was this pot shop, though. No one ever made a bowl of brown like them. So thick you could stand your spoon up in the bowl, with chunks of this and that. You ever have yourself a bowl of brown, Hoffman?"
"A time or two. Singer's stew, I call it."
"Why's that?"
"It tastes so good it makes me want to sing."
Kim liked that.
"Singer's stew. I'll ask for that next time I get back to Flea Bottom. What do you miss, Hoffman?"
"Jamie," thought Tyrion. "Shay, Taisha, my wife. I miss my wife, the wife I hardly knew."
"Wine, whores, and wealth," he answered. "Especially the wealth.
Wealth will buy you wine and whores.
It will also buy you swords, and the chems to wield them.
Is it true the chamber pots in Castle Rock are made of solid gold? Kim asked him.
You should not believe everything you hear, especially when House Lannister is concerned.
They say all Lannisters are twisty snakes.
Snakes? Tyrion laughed. That sound you hear is my lord father slithering in his grave. We are lions, or so we like to say. But it makes no matter, Kem. Step on a snake or a lion's tail, you'll end up just as dead. By then they had reached the armory, such as it was. The smith, this fabled hammer, proved to be a freakish-looking hulk with a left arm that appeared twice as thick as his right.
"He's drunk more than that," Kem said. "Brown Ben lets it go, but one day we'll get us a real armourer."
Hammer's apprentice was a wiry, red-haired youth called Nail. "Of course, what else?" mused Tyrion. Hammer was sleeping off a drunk when they reached the forge, just as Kem had prophesied. But Nail had no objection to the two dwarfs clambering through the wagons.
"Clap iron, most of it," he warned them, "but you're welcome to anything you can use."
Under roofs of bent wood and stiffened leather, the wagon beds were heaped high with old weaponry and armour. Tyrion took one look and sighed, remembering the gleaming racks of swords and spears and halberds in the armoury of the Lannisters below Castle Rock.
"This may take a while," he declared.
"There's sound still here, if you can find it," a deep voice growled. "None of it is pretty, but it will stop a sword."
A big knight stepped down from the back of a wagon, clad head to heel in company steel. His left greave did not match his right. His gorget was spotted with rust. His vambrises rich and ornate, inlaid with niello flowers. On his right hand was a gauntlet of lobstered steel. On his left, a fingerless mitt of rusted mail. The nipples on his muscled breastplate had a pair of iron rings through them. His great helm sported a ram's horns, one of which was broken. When he took it off, he revealed the battered face of Jorah Mormont.
"He looks every inch a sellsword, and not at all like the half-broken thing we took from Yesen's cage," Tyrion reflected.
His bruises had mostly faded by now, and the swelling in his face had largely subsided, so Mormont looked almost human once again, though only vaguely like himself. The demon's mask the slavers had burned into his right cheek to mark him for a dangerous and disobedient slave would never leave him. Ser Jorah had never been what one might call a comely man. The brand had transformed his face into something frightening. Tyrion grinned.
"As long as I look prettier than you, I will be happy."
He turned to Penny.
"You take that wagon. I'll start with this one."
"It will go faster if we look together."
She plucked up a rusted iron half-helm, giggled, and stuck it on her head.
"Do I look fearsome?"
"You look like a mama girl with a pot on her head." "That's a half-helm. You want a great helm."
He found one and swapped it for the half-helm.
"It's too big."
Penny's voice echoed hollowly inside the steel.
"I can't see out."
She took the helm off and flung it aside.
"What's wrong with a half-helm?"
"It's open-faced."
Tyrion pinched her nose.
"I am fond of looking at your nose. I would rather that you kept it."
Her eyes got big.
"You like my nose?"
"Oh, Seven, save me." Tyrion turned away and began rooting among some piles of old armour toward the back of the wagon.
"Are there any other parts of me you like?"
Penny asked. Perhaps she meant that to sound playful. It sounded sad instead.
"I am fond of all your parts," Tyrion said, in hopes of ending any further discussion of the subject. "And even fonder of mine own."
"Why should we need armour? We're only mummers. We just pretend to fight."
"You pretend very well,"
said Tyrion, examining a shirt of heavy iron mail, so full of holes that it almost looked moth-eaten.
What sorts of moths eat chainmail?
Pretending to be dead is one way to survive a battle. Good armour is another.
Though there's precious little of that here, I fear.
At the Green Fork, he had fought in mismatched scraps of plate from Lord Lefford's wagons, with a spike bucket helm that made it look as if someone had upended a slops pail over his head. This company steel was worse, not just old and ill-fitting, but dinted, cracked, and brittle.
Is that dried blood, or only rust?
He sniffed at it, but still could not be sure.
Here's a crossbow.
Penny showed it to him. Tyrion glanced at it. I cannot use a stirrup winch. My legs are not long enough. A clank would serve me better. Though, if truth be told, he did not want a crossbow. They took too long to reload. Even if he lurked by the latrine ditch, waiting for some enemy to take a squat, the chances of his loosing more than one quarrel would not be good. Instead, he picked up a morning star, gave it a swing, put it down again. Too heavy. He passed over a warhammer, too long. A studded mace, also too heavy, and half a dozen long swords before he found a dirk he liked, a nasty piece of steel with a triangular blade. This might serve, he said. The blade had a bit of rust on it, but that would only make it nastier. He found a wooden leather sheath that fit, and slipped the dirk inside.
A little sword for a little man,
joked Penny. It's a dirk, and made for a big man. Tyrion showed her an old longsword. This is a sword. Try it. Penny took it, swung it, frowned.
Too heavy.
Steel weighs more than wood. Chop through a man's neck with that thing, though, and his head is not like to turn into a melon. He took the sword back from her and inspected it more closely. Cheap steel, and notched. Here, see? I take back what I said. You need a better blade to hack off heads.
I don't want to hack off heads,
nor should you. Keep your cuts below the knee. Calf, hamstring, ankle, even giants fall if you slice their feet off. Once they're down, they're no bigger than you. Penny looked as though she were about to cry.
Last night, I dreamed my brother was alive again. We were jousting before some great lord, riding Crunch and Pretty Pig, and men were throwing roses at us. We were so happy.
Tyrion slapped her. It was a soft blow, all in all, a little flick of the wrist with hardly any force behind it. It did not even leave a mark upon her cheek, but her eyes filled with tears all the same. If you want a dream, go back to sleep, he told her. When you wake up, we'll still be escaped slaves in the middle of a siege. Crunch is dead. The pig as well, most like. Now find some armour and put it on, and never mind where it pinches. The mama show is over. Fight or hide or shit yourself, as you like. But whatever you decide to do, you'll do it clad in steel. Penny touched the cheek it slapped.
We should never have run. We're not sellswords. We're not any kind of swords. It wasn't so bad with yes, and it wasn't. Nurse was cruel sometimes, but yes, it never was. We were his favourites, his
slaves. The word you want is slaves.
Slaves, she said, flushing. We were his special slaves, though, just like sweets, his treasures.
His pets, thought Tyrion, and he loved us so much that he sent us to the pit to be devoured by lions. She was not all wrong. Yesen's slaves ate better than many peasants back in the Seven Kingdoms, and were less like to starve to death come winter. Slaves were chattels, aye. They could be bought and sold, whipped and branded, used for the carnal pleasure of their owners, bred to make more slaves. In that sense, they were no more than dogs or horses. But most lords treated their dogs and horses well enough. Proud men might shout that they would sooner die free than live as slaves. But pride was cheap. When the steel struck the flint, such men were rare as dragon's teeth. Elsewise the world would not have been so full of slaves. There has never been a slave who did not choose to be a slave, the dwarf reflected. Their choice may be between bondage and death, but the choice is always there. Tyrion Lannister did not accept himself. His tongue had earned him some stripes on the back in the beginning, but soon enough he had learned the tricks of pleasing Nurse and the noble Yezen. Jorah Mormont had fought longer and harder, but he would have come to the same place in the end. And Penny? Well, Penny had been searching for a new master since the day her brother Groat had lost his head. She wants someone to take care of her, someone to tell her what to do. It would have been too cruel to say so, however. Instead, Tyrion said, Yezan's special slaves did not escape the Pale Mare. They're dead, the lot of them. Sweets was the first to go. Their mammoth master had died on the day of their escape, Bran Ben Plum had told him. Neither he, nor Casporio, nor any of the other sellswords knew the fate of the denizens of Yezan's grotesquerie. But a pretty Penny needed lies to stop her mooning. Lie to her he would. If you want to be a slave again, I will find you a kind master when this war is done, and sell you for enough gold to get me home, Tyrion promised her. I'll find you some nice Yankish man to give you another pretty golden collar with little bells on it that will tinkle everywhere you go. First, though, you will need to survive what's coming. No one buys dead mummers.
Or dead dwarfs, said Jorah Mormont. We are all like to be feeding worms by the time this battle is done. The Yunkai have lost this war, though it may take them some time to know it. Meereen has an army of unsullied infantry, the finest in the world, and Meereen has dragons, three of them. Once the queen returns, she will. She must. Our side consists of 20 Yunkish lordlings, each with his own half-trained monkey men, slaves on stilts, slaves in chains. They may have troops of blind men and palsied children, too. I would not put it past them. Oh, I know, said Tyrion. The second sons are on the losing side. They need to turn their cloaks again, and do it now, he grinned. Leave that to me.
The Kingbreaker. A pale shadow and a dark. The two conspirators came together in the quiet of the armory on the Great Pyramid's second level, amongst racks of spears, sheaves of quarrels, and walls hung with trophies from forgotten battles.
Tonight, said Skarhaz Mokandak,
the brass face of a bloodbat peered out from beneath the hood of his patchwork cloak.
All my men will be in place. The word is Grolio.
Grolio? That is fitting, I suppose. Yes, what was done to him? You were at court.
One guardsman amongst 40, all waiting for the emptied tabard on the throne, to speak the command so we might cut down Bloodbeard and the rest. Do you think the Yunkai would ever have dared present Daenerys with the head of her hostage?
No, thought Selmy. His Dar seemed distraught.
Sham, his own kin of Lorik were returned unarmed. You saw. The Yunkai played as a mummer's farce, with noble Hisdar as chief mummer. The issue was never Yerkaz Zoyunsek. The other slavers would gladly have trampled that old fool themselves. This was to give Hisdar a pretext to kill the dragons.
Sir Barristan chewed on that.
Would he dare? He dared to kill his queen. Why not her pets?
If we do not act, Hisdar will hesitate for a time to give proof of his reluctance and allow the wise masters the chance to rid him of the Stormcrow and the Bloodrider. Then he will act. They want the dragons dead before the Volantine fleet arrives.
Aye, they would. It all fit. That did not mean Barristan Selmy liked it any better.
That will not happen.
His queen was the mother of dragons. He would not allow her children to come to harm. The hour of the wolf, the blackest part of night, when all the world's asleep. He had first heard those words from Tywin Lannister, outside the walls of Duskendale. He gave me a day to bring out Aerys. Unless I returned with the king by dawn of the following day, he would take the town with steel and fire, he told me. It was the hour of the wolf when I went in, and the hour of the wolf when we emerged. Grey Worm and the Unsullied will close and bar the gates at first light.
Better to attack at first light, Scarhouse said. Burst from the gates and swarm across the siege lines. Smash the Yunkai as they come stumbling from their beds.
No, the two of them had argued this before. There is a peace, signed and sealed by Her Grace the Queen. We will not be the first to break it. Once we have taken Hisdar, we will form a council to rule in his place, and demand that the Yunkai return our hostages and withdraw their armies. Should they refuse, then and only then will we inform them that the peace is broken and go forth to give them battle. Your way is dishonorable.
Your way is stupid, the Shavepate said. The hour is ripe. Our freedmen are ready, hungry.
Well, that much was true, Selmy knew. Simon Striteback of the Free Brothers and Malono Yasdob of the Stalwart Shields were both eager for battle, intent on proving themselves and washing out all the wrongs they had suffered in a tide of Yunkish blood. Only Marcellin of the Mother's Men shared Sir Barristan's doubts.
We discussed this. You agreed it would be my way.
Agreed, the Shavepate grumbled. But that was before Grolio, the head. The slavers have no honour.
We do, said Sir Barristan. The Shavepate muttered something in Gascari, then said,
As you wish, though we will rue your old man's honour before this game is done, I think. What of Hisdar's guards?
His Grace keeps two men by him when he sleeps, one on the door of his bedchamber, a second within, in an adjoining alcove. Tonight it will be Kraz and Steelskin.
Kraz, the Shavepate grumbled. That I do not like.
It need not come to blood, Sir Barristan told him. I mean to talk to Hisdar. If he understands we do not intend to kill him, he may command his guards to yield.
And if not, Hisdar must not escape us.
He will not escape. Selmy did not fear Kraz, much less Steelskin. They were only pitch fighters. Hisdar's fearsome collection of former fighting slaves made indifferent guards at best. Speed and strength and ferocity they had, and some skill at arms as well, but blood games were poor training for protecting kings. In the pits their foes were announced with horns and drums, and after the battle was done and won, the victors could have their wounds bound up and quaff some milk of the poppy for the pain, knowing that the threat was past and they were free to drink and feast and whore until the next fight. But the battle was never truly done for a knight of the king's guard. Threats came from everywhere and nowhere, at any time of day or night. No trumpets announced the foe, vassals, servants, friends, brothers, sons, even wives. Any of them might have knives concealed beneath their cloaks and murder hidden in their hearts. For every hour of fighting, a Kingsguard knight spent 10,000 hours watching, waiting, standing silent in the shadows. King Hisdar's pit fighters were already growing bored and restive with their new duties, and bored men were lax, slow to react. "I shall deal with Kraz," said Sir Barristan. "Just make certain I do not need to deal with any brazen beasts as well."
"Have no fear. We will have Margaz in chains before he can make mischief. I told you, the brazen beasts are mine."
"You say you have men amongst the Yunkish men.
Sneaks and spies. Resnak has more."
"Resnak cannot be trusted. He smells too sweet and feels too foul. Someone needs to free our hostages. Unless we get our people back,
the Yunkai will use them against us. Scar has snorted through the nose holes of his mask.
Easy to speak of rescue, harder to do. Let the slavers threaten.
And if they do more than threaten?
Would you miss them so much, old man? A eunuch, a savage, and a sellsword?
Hero, Jogo, and Dario. Jogo is the queen's blood rider, blood of her blood. They came out of the red waste together. Hero is Grey Worm's second in command. And Dario...
She loves Dario. He had seen it in her eyes when she looked at him, heard it in her voice when she spoke of him.
Dario is vain and rash, but he is dear to her grace. He must be rescued before his storm crows decide to take matters into their own hands. It can be done. I once brought the Queen's father safely out of Duskendale, where he was being held captive by a rebel lord, but...
You could never hope to pass unnoticed amongst the Yunkai. Every man of them knows your face by now.
I could hide my face like you, thought Selmy. But he knew the shave page was right. Duskendale had been a lifetime ago. He was too old for such heroics. Then we must needs find some other way, some other rescuer, someone known to the Yunkish men whose presence in their camp might go unnoticed.
Dario calls you Sir Grandfather,
Scarhaz reminded him.
I will not say what he calls me. If you and I were the hostages, would he risk his skin for us?
Not likely, he thought, but he said, he might.
Dario might piss on us if we were burning. Elsewise, do not look to him for help. Let the storm crows choose another captain, one who knows his place. If the queen does not return, the world will be one sellsword short. Who will grieve?
And when she does return?
She will weep and tear her hair and curse the Yunkai, not us. No blood on our hands. You can comfort her, tell her some tale of the old days. She likes those. Poor Dario, her brave captain, she will never forget him, no. But better for all of us, if he is dead, yes? Better for Daenerys, too.
Better for Daenerys and for Westeros. Daenerys Targaryen loved her captain, but that was the girl in her, not the queen. Prince Rhaegar loved his lady Lyanna, and thousands died for it. Daemon Blackfyre loved the first Daenerys and rose in rebellion when denied her. Bittersteel and Bloodraven both loved She-Era Seastar and the Seven Kingdoms Bled. The Prince of Dragonflies loved Jenny of Oldstones so much he cast aside a crown, and Westeros paid the bride price in corpses. All three of the sons of the fifth Aegon had wed for love, in defiance of their father's wishes, and because that unlikely monarch had himself followed his heart when he chose his queen, he allowed his sons to have their way, making bitter enemies where he might have had fast friends. Treason and turmoil followed, as night follows day, ending at Summerhall in sorcery, fire, and grief.
Her love for Dario is poison, a slower poison than the locust, but in the end as deadly. There is still Jogo, Sir Barristan said. Him and Hero, both precious to her grace.
We have hostages as well, Scarhaz Shavepate reminded him. If the slavers kill one of ours, we kill one of theirs.
For a moment Sir Barristan did not know whom he meant. Then it came to him. The Queen's cupbearers?
Hostages,
insisted Scarhaz Mokandak.
Grazda and Khazar are the blood of the Green Grace. Mazara is a Merrick. Kesmar is Pal, Azak Gazin. Bakaz is Lorik, Hisdar's own kin. All are sons and daughters of the pyramids. Zak, Quasar, Yulez, Hazkar, Dazak, Yerizan, all children of great masters.
Innocent girls and sweet-faced boys. Sir Barristan had come to know them all during the time they served the queen.
Grazar with his dreams of glory, shy Mazara, lazy Miklas, vain pretty Kesmia, Keza with her big soft eyes and angel's voice, Daza the dancer, and the rest. Children, children of the Arpi, only blood can pay for blood. So said the youngish man who brought us Grolier's head.
He was not wrong.
I will not permit it.
What use are hostages, if they may not be touched?
Mayhaps we might offer three of the children for Dario, Hero, and Jogo, Sir Barristan allowed. Her Grace
is not here. It is for you and me to do what must be done. You know that I'm right.
Prince Rhaegar had two children, Sir Barristan told him. Rhaenys was a little girl, Aegon a babe in arms. When Tywin Lannister took King's Landing, his men killed both of them. He served the bloody bodies up in crimson cloaks, a gift for the new king. And what did Robert say when he saw them? Did he smile? Barristan Selmy had been badly wounded on the Trident, so he had been spared the sight of Lord Tarwin's gift. But oft he wondered, if I had seen him smile over the red ruins of Rhaegar's children, no army on this earth could have stopped me from killing him. I will not suffer the murder of children. Accept that, or I'll have no part of this. Scarhaz chuckled.
You are a stubborn old man. Your sweet-faced boys will only grow up to be sons of the Harpy. Kill them now, or kill them then.
You kill men for the wrongs they have done, not the wrongs that they may do some day. The shapemate took an axe down off the wall, inspected it, and grunted.
So be it. No harm to Isdar or our hostages. Will that content you, Sir Grandfather?
Nothing about this will content me.
It will serve. The Hour of the Wolf, remember?
I'm not like to forget, sir.
Though the bat's brass mouth did not move, Sir Barristan could sense the grin beneath the mask.
Long has Kandak waited for this night.
That is what I fear. If King Hisdar was innocent, what they did this day would be treason. But how could he be innocent?
Selmy had heard him urging Daenerys to taste the poison locusts, shouting at his men to slay the dragon. If we do not act, Hisdar will kill the dragons and open the gates to the queen's enemies. We have no choice in this. Yet no matter how he turned and twisted this, the old knight could find no honour in it. The rest of that long day raced past as swiftly as a snail. Elsewhere, he knew, King Hisdar was consulting with Resnek Mo Resnek, Margaz Olorek, Galaza Galari, and his other Myrinese advisers, deciding how best to respond to Yunkai's demands. But Barristan Selmy was no longer a part of such councils, nor did he have a king to guard. Instead, he made the rounds of the pyramid from top to bottom to ascertain that the sentries were all at their posts. That took most of the morning. He spent that afternoon with his orphans, even took up sword and shield himself to provide a sterner test for a few of the older lads. Some of them had been training for the fighting pits when Daenerys Targaryen took Meereen and freed them from their chains. Those had had a good acquaintance with sword and spear and battle-axe, even before Sir Barristan got hold of them. A few might well be ready. The boy from the Basilisk Isles, for a start, Tumko Lo. Black as Maester's ink he was, but fast and strong, the best natural swordsman Selmy had seen since Jaime Lannister. Larrick as well, the lash. Sir Barristan did not approve of his fighting style, but there was no doubting his skills. Larrick had years of work ahead of him before he mastered proper knightly weapons, sword and lance and mace, but he was deadly with his whip and trident. The old knight had warned him that the whip would be useless against an armoured foe, until he saw how Larrick used it, snapping it around the legs of his opponents to yank them off their feet. No knight as yet but a fierce fighter.
Larrick and Tumko were his best. After them, the Lazarine, the one the other boys called Red Lamb. Though as yet, that one was all ferocity and no technique. Perhaps the brothers, too. Three low-born Gescari, enslaved to pay their father's debts. That made six. Six out of 27. Selmy might have hoped for more, but six was a good beginning. The other boys were younger for the most part, and more familiar with looms and ploughs and chamber pots than swords and shields. But they worked hard and learned quickly. A few years as squires, and he might have six more knights to give his queen. As for those who would never be ready, well, not every boy was meant to be a knight. The realm needs candle-makers and innkeepers and armourers as well. That was as true in Meereen as it was in Westeros. As he watched them at their drills, Sir Barristan pondered raising Tomko and Larrick to knighthood then and there. And mayhaps the Red Lamb, too. It required a knight to make a knight, and if something should go awry tonight, Dawn might find him dead or in a dungeon. Who would dub his squires then? On the other hand, a young knight's repute derived at least in part from the honour of the man who conferred knighthood on him. It would do his lads no good at all if it was known that they were given their spurs by a traitor, and might well land them in the dungeon next to him. They deserved better, Sir Barristan decided. Better a long life as a squire than a short one as a soiled knight. As the afternoon melted into evening, he bid his charges to lay down their swords and shields and gather round. He spoke to them about what it meant to be a knight. "It is chivalry that makes a true knight, not a sword," he said. "Without honour, a knight is no more than a common killer. It is better to die with honour than to live without it." The boys looked at him strangely, he thought, but one day they would understand. Afterward, back at the apex of the pyramid, Sir Barristan found Missandei amongst piles of scrolls and books, reading. "Stay here tonight, child," he told her. "Whatever happens, whatever you see or hear, do not leave the queen's chambers." "This one hears," the girl said. "If she may ask..." "Best not." Sir Barristan stepped out, alone onto the terrace gardens. "I am not made for this," he reflected, as he looked out over the sprawling city. The pyramids were waking one by one, lanterns and torches flickering to life as shadows gathered in the streets below. Plots, ploys, whispers, lies, secrets within secrets, and somehow I have become part of them. Perhaps by now he should have grown used to such things. The Red Keep had its secrets, too. Even Rhaegar, the Prince of Dragonstone, had never trusted him as he had trusted Arthur Dayne. Harrenhal was proof of that. The year of the false spring. The memory was still bitter. Old Lord Went had announced the tourney shortly after a visit from his brother, Sir Oswald Went of the King's Guard. With Varys whispering in his ear, King Aerys became convinced that his son was conspiring to depose him, that Went's tourney was but a ploy to give Rhaegar a pretext for meeting with as many great lords as could be brought together. Aerys had not set foot outside the Red Keep since Duskendale, yet suddenly he announced that he would accompany Prince Rhaegar to Harrenhal, and everything had gone awry from there. "If I had been a better knight, if I had unhorsed the prince in that last tilt, as I unhorsed so many others, it would have been for me to choose the Queen of Love and Beauty." Rhaegar had chosen Lyanna Stark of Winterfell. Barristan Selmy would have made a different choice. Not the queen who was not present, nor Elia of Dawn. Though she was good and gentle, had she been chosen, much war and woe might have been avoided. His choice would have been a young maiden, not long at court, one of Elia's companions. Though compared to Ashara Dayne, the Dornish princess was a kitchen drab. Even after all these years, Sir Barristan could still recall Ashara's smile, the sound of her laughter.
He had only to close his eyes to see her, with her long, dark hair tumbling about her shoulders and those haunting purple eyes. Daenerys has the same eyes. Sometimes, when the queen looked at him, he felt as if he were looking at Ashara's daughter. But Ashara's daughter had been stillborn, and his fair lady had thrown herself from a tower soon after, mad with grief for the child she had lost, and perhaps for the man who had dishonored her at Harrenhal as well. She died never knowing that Sir Barristan had loved her. How could she? He was a knight of the king's guard, sworn to celibacy. No good could have come from telling her his feelings. No good came from silence either. If I had unhorsed Rhaegar and crowned Ashara queen of love and beauty, might she have looked to me instead of Stark? He would never know. But of all his failures, none haunted Barristan Selmy so much as that. The sky was overcast, the air hot, muggy, oppressive. Yet there was something in it that made his spine tingle. Rain, he thought. A storm is coming, if not tonight, upon the morrow. Sir Barristan wondered if he would live to see it. If Hisdar has his own spider, I'm as good as dead. Should it come to that, he meant to die as he had lived, with his long sword in his hand. When the last light had faded in the west, behind the sails of the prowling ships on Slaver's Bay, Sir Barristan went back inside, summoned a pair of serving men, and told them to heat some water for a bath. Sparring with his squires in the afternoon heat had left him feeling soiled and sweaty. The water, when it came, was only lukewarm, but Selmy lingered in the bath until it had grown cold, and scrubbed his skin till it was raw. Clean as he had ever been, he rose, dried himself, and clad himself in whites. Stockings, small clothes, silken tunic, padded jerkin, all fresh washed and bleached. Over that he donned the armour that the queen had given him as a token of her esteem. The mail was gilded, finely wrought, the links as supple as good leather, the plate enamelled, hard as ice and bright as new-fallen snow. His dagger went on one hip, his long sword on the other, hung from a white leather belt with golden buckles. Last of all, he took down his long white cloak and fastened it about his shoulders. The helm he left upon its hook. The narrow eye-slit limited his vision, and he needed to be able to see for what was to come. The halls of the pyramid were dark at night, and foes could come at you from either side. Besides, though the ornate dragon's wings that adorned the helm were splendid to look upon, they could too easily catch a sword or axe. He would leave them for his next tourney, if the Seven should grant him one. Armed and armoured, the old knight waited, sitting in the gloom of his small chamber adjoining the queen's apartments. The faces of all the kings that he had served and failed floated before him in the darkness, and the faces of the brothers who had served beside him in the king's guard as well. He wondered how many of them would have done what he was about to do. Some, surely, but not all. Some would not have hesitated to strike down the shaved pate as a traitor. Outside the pyramid, it began to rain. Sir Barristan sat alone in the dark, listening. It sounds like tears, he thought. It sounds like dead kings weeping. Then it was time to go. The Great Pyramid of Meereen had been built as an echo to the Great Pyramid of Giss, whose colossal ruins Lomas Longstrider had once visited. Like its ancient predecessor, whose red marble halls were now the haunt of bats and spiders, the Meereenese pyramid boasted 33 levels, that number being somehow sacred to the gods of Giss. Sir Barristan began the long descent alone, his white cloak rippling behind him as he started down. He took the servant steps, not the grand stairways of vein marble, but the narrower, steeper, straighter stairs, hidden within the thick brick walls. 12 levels down he found the shaved pate waiting, his coarse features still hidden by the mask he had worn that morning, the blood bat. Six brazen beasts were with him. All were masked as insects, identical to one another.
Locusts,
Selmy realized.
Grolio